We are thrilled to be joined today and to bring you this episode with Dr. Daniel Crosby. He's a clinical psychologist. More importantly today, he's a behavioral finance expert. He works at Orion, which is one of our major technology platforms we use here at Full Sail. But his goal and what he does for them and what he does for multiple organizations is help them understand just the intersection of mind and market. So we are thrilled to have Dr. Daniel Crosby joining us today, Zooming in remotely. So I am joined here in studio by Zach Reynolds, our Chief Investment Officer, and Jordan Dean from the advisory team. So thank you both for joining me. Candace is not mic'd up, but she's going to listen in, and we'll have her on to debrief here in the back. So, all right, well, let's jump right in. We'll get to our conversation with Dr. Daniel Crosby. We are so grateful for the time, and I hope you guys enjoy. Dr. Crosby, thank you so much for joining us again. It's been a little while, and you have since come out with a brand new book, The Soul of Wealth, where we're going to spend a lot of our time today. But thank you again for being here. If you don't mind, just give us maybe a brief background on yourself and, you know, a little bit of a Daniel Crosby 101, if you don't mind, just to kind of let the listeners know the who and the what of who you are.
Yeah, for sure. Happy to be back. Thanks for having me back. I'm Daniel Crosby. I am a clinical psychologist by education. So I studied to be a shrink, but have spent my whole career on Wall Street, basically applying principles of human behavior to how we make decisions with our money. So I'm the chief behavioral officer at Orion. It was recently pointed out to me that more people have been to space than have my job titles. I don't know if that makes me very special or very goofy, but I basically study the psychology of money and how humans make messy, imperfect decisions with their money, get to build tech, talk to people, write books, do all kinds of fun stuff. So it's been a great life and a great career.
Oh, that's great. I think it just makes you unique. It's not goofy at all. I love the title. Well, I want to spend a lot of our time today on your new book, The Soul of Wealth. It is a book that we are going to be handing out and sending out to a lot of our clients and our network, because we are so focused on trying to continue to educate investors with this behavioral finance side of the world. If you read the book, you'll see why we think so. But if you don't mind, so The Soul of Wealth is 50 reflections on money and meaning. And of those 50, I thought it'd be fun to not only let Jordan and Zach, but also you kind of highlight any of your favorite ones. Were there a couple that stuck out? Were there a couple that you knew from day one were going to be part of this?
Yeah, well, I'll start with one which I believe is toward the back of the book. It's hard for me to remember where everything landed, but I believe it's toward the back of the book, and it's the most personal. So I'll start with that okay. one. In early 2021, I thought I was dying.
Oh.
I started out with some sort of vague symptoms, but they got really intense over a couple of weeks. And there was almost this like electric, fuzzy, staticky burning in my head. I would go blind in my left eye for periods of time, had really bad migraines, sensitivity to light. It was just this debilitating pain in my head. And so I went to WebMD, which is a nightmare, right? Like anyone who's ever Googled their symptoms on WebMD, they give you a very scary list. But, you know, I'm a scientist, so I started with the least invasive, the least intrusive suggestion, which was a tooth problem.
Okay.
And so I went to my dentist and got a bunch of x-rays and got checked out. And my dentist is like, no, like, you know, you've never had a cavity. Like, this isn't anything more serious than this. It's not your teeth. So having ruled out kind of the one non-scary option, I, you know, proceeded to, you know, a psychiatrist and a neurologist and a full body scan and MRIs and CAT scans and, you know, oxygen therapy. I spent probably $10,000 over the course of the next couple of months just trying to get answers. And the pain just kept getting worse and worse. And one day, you know, kind of flash forward, I'm sitting in the passenger seat of my wife's car and she's driving me to the emergency room because I'm just in excruciating pain. And I've got three young children and I'm crying my eyes out. And, you know, I'm someone who loves money. Right. You know, I'm money motivated. I think about money. I write about money. I talk about money all day. But I told my wife in that moment, I'm like, I would give every penny I have to figure this out. Like, I would give you every penny I have for an answer to this problem and relief from this problem. 2 weeks later, I bit into a sandwich and my tooth cracked in half. Oh. And it had been my tooth the whole time. Yeah. And the dentist had just missed it. And because we had sort of ruled that out, I just never thought about it. You know, I never looked at it again. And, you know, it was nothing. They pulled the tooth and then I was fine. You know, it was the smallest thing possible for me clenching my jaw at night. But in that moment, you know, this idea that health is wealth became everything to me. And, you know, in that chapter, you know, and since then I've gone on kind of a personal, that it was sort of, you know, the catalyst for a larger journey. I've lost almost 60 pounds. I've gotten in, you know, the best shape of my life. And all of this was catalyzed by this thing. But for someone, we talk about this, right? We talk about the idea that health is wealth. But when you're sick, you want one thing.
Yep.
When you're healthy, you want a million things. When you're sick, you want one thing. And I think a lot of times in the US, we deprioritize our health in pursuit of greater financial wealth. And I think that's a huge mistake. And, you know, write about that quite personally in that chapter.
One part of the book, Dr. Crosby, that reminds me of is you write about if you could be the fifth most wealthy person in the world, but you find out, of course, it's Warren Buffett and you have to be 93. Yeah. No one would take that deal. And you right. call out that what that is effectively saying is that you're putting $1 billion worth of value on every subsequent year you could live. So I thought that was a great way to kind of frame thinking about things that may be more important than money. But no, I love that part of the book.
Yeah, thank you. That's fun, right? I mean, you think, yeah, do you want $100 billion? Yeah, sure. Well, do you want to be 90 something and eat like a toddler like Warren Buffett does? You know, well, not so fast. Well, what does that say about the value of our years? You know, and yet we don't act like that. The reason I had 60 pounds to lose is because I had worked so hard, like in large part. You know, I had spent so much time on the road and high stress jobs and things like that I had let other stuff slip. And I think that's a big mistake. And it took this sort of mystery illness for me to really, for that to be driven home to me in a big way. I hope other people can, you know, learn from my mistake.
Well, congratulations. We usually do these without video, but we're seeing you on Zoom and you're looking very svelte, as I told you before we started. So congratulations. I'm curious, you've talked a little bit on LinkedIn about how there are some parallels between your fitness journey and, you know, things like discipline and investing. Could you talk to us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I had Dr. Michael Finca on my podcast a little while ago. He's actually Dr. Doctor. He has two PhDs, unlike my lame one PhD. So Dr. Michael Finca. And the reason he has two PhDs is because he started out as a nutritionist. And he found out, he started out in nutrition research, and then he found quite coincidentally that people who had good nutritional diet habits also were exceptional savers. And there's so many analogs, right? You know, I talk one of the other chapters in the book, you know, I forget the exact title of the chapter, but basically, you know, delayed gratification is the ultimate life hack sort of thing. I mean, there's this almost every problem we encounter in life. You know, whether it's getting out of shape or, you know, cheating on your spouse or a million other things in between, it's from privileging the moment more than the long term. And he found that like people who had been able to put one thing together had been able to put the other together. You know, for me, the other thing, the way that I did without making this a whole diet, podcast, I mean, I had two rules. You know, I had two rules. I started on April 1st. We're here at the end of October and I've, you know, lost 57.5 pounds, but who's counting, right?
Yeah. So, no, you should count. That's awesome.
Yeah, we're down to the half. I'm counting every half pound. Yeah. I had two rules, right? Stay under a calorie goal and stay over a protein goal. That was it. And within those two rules, I had maximum flexibility. right? Like, I mean, I talked about online, like I eat a Snickers bar every single day. Like I get up and I enter a Snickers bar into my little food tracking app because by God, that's happening, right? You know? So I think, you know, money's the same way. You just need to get a couple of things right, you know, maximize the engine of your wealth, diversify your assets, work with a professional, leave it alone. Like if people would follow three or four rules, they'd be off to the races. But for me, there was a lack of information, right? Like if you had asked me, how many calories do you eat in a day? I would have said, you know, I don't know, 2000.
Right.
but then when I started tracking, I started off at 2300 and I was losing 3 pounds a week eating 2300 calories a day. So you're like, oh, I wasn't eating 2000 calories a day. I was eating 3000 calories a day. And that's what the research shows, that we underestimate how much we eat by about 50%. We overestimate how much we move by about that same margin. So you got to get clear information. And that's what I think working with an advisor can do for a lot of people. Getting that financial plan can give you a clear roadmap, because if you haven't sat down and articulated it and accounted for every dollar, you're missing information the same way that I was.
Tagging on the health, the power of habits is something you've talked about, which is also an incredible book. But let's dive in a little bit there, because I think there is so much correlation between health and wealth. And to your point, just doing a couple things, a couple small things, or changing one or two things can have a major impact on your wealth or your wealth future. So what did you learn in kind of looking at the habits of people, of successful, wealthy people?
Yeah. So I'll kind of combine two chapters. There's a chapter on willpower and there's a chapter on habits that I think are both instructive here. You know, one thing is we've all kind of heard this old saw that it takes whatever, 3 weeks to form a habit. It turns out it takes anywhere from about 18 days to about 200 days to form a habit. So that was one thing that my research around this kind of shed some new light on for me, that, you know, depending on who you are and what you're trying to do, that habit might take months, you know, that habit might take months to get right. But we see if you combine it with the willpower chapter, there's all this research on like how much better off people with willpower are. You know, they're in better shape, they're richer, on and on and on, better relationships. But we found that willpower really comes down to just like a couple of things. The first was habits, right? It's not that they have like nerves of steel or will of steel. It's just habitual at this point, and it's sort of muscle memory at this point, and it's second nature. And then even more importantly than that, people with willpower avoid temptation. You know, if you think about, you know, an alcoholic shouldn't hang out at a bar, you know, someone on a diet, part of the conversation I had to have with my family, my wife is as tall as I am and is very thin and just has great genes. Shout out Scandinavia. Like shout out Norway for just having great genes. So I said, look, I can't eat like you. You know, we can't have this in the house, because if it's in the house, I'm going to eat it. And so it's less about having, you know, steely willpower and more just staying out of harm's way. Yeah. You know, not putting yourself in a position to get sideways. Control your media diet, right? If you don't want to be short term in your financial thinking, you shouldn't be tuning into financial news every day, right? When my statement comes from my advisor, I rip that thing up. Like, I don't care. You know, I don't, that's not the game I'm playing. I'm not playing a monthly game. I'm not playing a quarterly game. I'm playing a decades game.
Absolutely.
And so getting those habits in order, you know, anywhere from a couple of weeks to a couple of months, and then avoiding temptation is the biggest and the best thing that you can do.
I'm glad you brought up the media diet. That was one of my favorite chapters. And I think you posted this recently too. The election's coming up. I think this podcast will come out after the election, but regardless, that's probably the things the thing our clients are talking to us and are most concerned about right now. And you had, I think, five different things that people should keep in mind as they're consuming media. Could maybe call out a few of those, because I think it's really useful as people. The media is all about raising emotion, because that's clicks and that's viewership and that's dollars for them. And I think your suggestions can really help put that in context.
Yeah, for sure. So a little backstory on where this idea even came from. You know, again, I'm a clinical psychologist. I actually got into this work because I wanted to work with women with eating disorders. That was why I got a PhD in the first place, because I had a loved one who had an eating disorder, and the process of helping her was what got me to fall in love with psychology. So when I was working at this inpatient eating disorder treatment center, you know, I'm becoming aware of the treatment protocol. The very first thing they do with these women who come into this like very high dollar inpatient facility is they give them media training. It's not nutrition training. It's not therapy. It's media training so that they can become empowered and informed consumers of the way that beauty standards are pitched to women.
Huh.
And I thought that was such an empowering and a positive sort of first step to say, hey, look, what you see is not what you get, right? There's airbrushing, there's lighting, there's touch-ups, there's starvation diets, there's misery, there's all this stuff. And they're trying to make you feel bad about yourself to sell you some whatever, makeup or Spanx or whatever, you know, whatever it is, right?
Yeah.
You didn't know we were going to talk about Spanx on this podcast.
I did not have that on my bingo card.
But that was not on the bingo card, but here we are. You know, the same thing is true of investors. So one of the things that we have to keep in mind is, how are they compensated? You know, financial advisors are compensated on your success, right? Financial professionals get compensated by and large so that when you win, they win. That's a good model, right? The media gets compensated for your eyeballs and your clicks. And we know that what bleeds leads. We know that bad news does a lot better than good news. And we also know that markets go up a lot more than they go down. So the honest thing to do would to have 8 out of every 10 articles in financial news media be very optimistic, because that's about the proportion of the time that the market goes up. But guess what? That's not how it works. So that, because that's not how they get incentivized. So you have to, you know, the first thing is you have to become an informed consumer of media. You have to understand how they get incentivized. You also have to like question the sources. You know, I was again at the gym in the morning. They have every flavor of the political spectrum news on, you know, they have sort of like left, right, center, whatever center is these days. But, you know, they have sort of like different flavors of financial news on the TVs at the gym in the morning. And I was watching an unnamed news source the other day, and they had a WWE wrestler on talking about inflation and the economy. And I'm like so frustrated, because I'm going, this person, like, there are people, mom and pop are at home watching this, trusting a guy who runs around and body slams other men in his underwear for a living on what they should do with their money. And they have no business having an opinion on this. So you got to understand what's being sold. You got to understand the compensation scheme. You need to question the melodrama. Are they using emotion to try and get you to do something? And, you know, question the credibility of the source, because the best and smartest people in the world have a hard time forecasting financial markets. So I don't know what wrestlers, you know, are going to do.
So true. It's so true. It's unbelievable. That makes me think of there's a whole chapter on learn what to ignore as well. And that goes for, I think we just covered it, but, you know, do I have a reason to believe the accuracy of this information? And if a wrestler is talking about inflation, the answer is no.
No.
or even, I mean, you call it out in the book, and I'm a chartered financial analyst myself. So you talk about the CFAs trying to forecast market returns over the next year, something we've written about several times the last few years, how bad Wall Street is at predicting what returns are going to be in the future. And you call out 2020. And as we all know, if you had told people we're going to have a global pandemic that shuts down the entire world economy, you would predict negative market returns. And of course, it was a fantastic year in the markets.
Yeah, that's what's so tricky about forecasts. Yeah, you think about 2020, people undershot it without knowing that we were going to shut down the entire world economy and that millions of people would die of a novel virus, right? I mean, imagine how much worse it would have been had we known. If you go back to 2016, right? If you think about the presidential election in 2016, nobody thought, or very few people thought, Trump would win, right? So you've got to get that right, which very few people did. And the people who thought Trump was going to win forecast sort of very dramatically negative things for the economy as a result of that. So you had an unexpected win, then you had a further unexpected result on top of that. There's just orders of complexity, and it's much easier to just follow a set of rules than to try and predict the future. You know, I had a friend ask me recently, he said, what is your goal? I'm like, how many books do you want to sell? And I was like, I mean, millions. You know, but I said, look, that is out of my control. Like, I wrote the best book I could. I wrote a book I'm proud of. Here's what I'm going to do to promote it. You know, I'm going to appear on 100 podcasts and do like all this stuff to promote it. And then that's how many, like, I can control the process. I can't control the outcomes. And I think a lot of times we try and over-index on outcomes. We try and forecast outcomes. We would be much better off worrying about our process and make sure we're doing kind of the right process bits.
That sounds like Annie Duke, another author we really enjoy.
Yeah, she's great.
Yeah.
Another theme that was really woven throughout the book was the concept of there being just a higher level or a higher view of wealth. Like, it's not because I want to go and eat a really nice steak dinner next week. It's not because I want to, it's not all about saving for some large purchase. It's what is the why behind your money? And your money does need a why. And I liked, I mean, you even had the example of and we do this actually around here, but renaming an account instead of account XYZ, you named it Olivia and Sophia's savings account. So there's a why associated with it. Talk a little bit about how we just mentally start to associate with that account differently by naming it and giving it a why. Because I think that's so powerful when we can help investors, savers, people understand that side of it.
Yeah, I'm a meaning and purpose fanatic. My next book, just, you know, this one's only been out for a week, but I can already tell you that my next book will be solely about finding meaning and purpose. If you think about, I'm gonna go right back to the very beginning. If you think about everything we ask clients to do, it is so hard. Like, we ask people to save money when psychologically people perceive saving money as a present loss. Like, it hurts. Any dollar I save today is a dollar I can't spend on going to a movie or buying a Porsche or buying a Snickers bar or whatever, right? It hurts. Like, it hurts to save money. It's hard. We ask people to be long-term when humans are wired to be short-term. We ask them to take on risk and uncertainty when we're wired for certainty. So everything you need to do to put together a competent financial life is psychologically difficult. The only way past that no, that everything inside your mind and your heart and your body is screaming, no, don't do this, is to have a yes that is bigger than that no. And that yes is your purpose. And so that's why we see it so profoundly. A couple of quick stats on this.
Yeah.
Morningstar found that people who had labeled their accounts in the way that you do there had 15% more than their sort of same income peers. SEI found during the Great Financial Crisis that people were 10 times less likely to liquidate their accounts if they were named or if they were values-based. Because it's really easy to sell the S&P 500. It's very hard to sell kids' college fund or the women's leadership fund or whatever. Like, once... Yeah. Once we've personalized that, once we've made it personally significant, it's a much different animal. So, you know, bigger account balances, less likely to panic. A 2009 study by Chima and Soman found that people who looked at a picture of their kids before they made a financial decision, 5-second glance at a picture of your kids, saved more than twice as much as a control group. So we just see again and again and again that integrating money and meaning is so powerful. You should be naming your dollars. You should be revisiting your why. And you know, the last thing that I'll talk about here, there's research in there from Dr. Klontz that talks about visualization. You know, a lot of times we as financial professionals will say, hey, you know, what's your financial goal? Like, well, I want to get a lake house. And we go, okay, cool. Well, lake house costs whatever, $500,000. We'll start setting aside for it. What they found was the more you could visualize that, with the greater granularity with which you could visualize that lake house, the more likely you were to save for it. So we should go, oh, you want a lake house? Like which lake? Like what kind of trees are you going to have around it? One story or two story? Like how close to the lake? You're going to have a dock? Like, I mean, we need to help them get this whole vision for where they're headed, and just integrating that meaning and that vivid vision into every part of our financial lives is the way that we get past the fear that we're sort of more naturally wired for.
Oh, so good. The other areas or thoughts that I think tie into the why is, you talked about it throughout the book also, was just gratitude and generosity in different areas. And I think that's something that I'm very passionate about, that I think there's so much that can be done when money's in the right hands. And I say right, just in the hands of people that are looking to do good. I think there's so much that can get done in the world when people have that mindset. So what did you find when you were looking at the gratitude, generosity side of things? Anything surprise you in your research there?
Yeah, a lot. So, you know, one of the things that I love about this is whenever I'm looking for like capital T truth, I think one of the things that we want to do is look at ideas that are found in every wisdom tradition, like every faith, every philosophy. And this idea that generosity is a path to prosperity is one that you see everywhere. Mm. It's in the Bhagavad Gita, it's in the Bible, it's in the Tao Te Ching, it's in the Quran. It's absolutely everywhere, that basically saying like, hey, if you give money away, more will come back to you. And it's funny because mathematically that's nonsense, right? Like mathematically the math ain't mathing. You know, that doesn't seem like it should be true, but you know, here's what we found. First of all, we found that this is present in children as young as two.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, children as young as two receive this happiness. They call it this warm glow from giving something away, but only if it's costly to them personally. It can't be like, hey, I have a candy bar and my mom gave me another candy bar, so now I can share it with my friend. It's like, no, I got to take my candy bar and break it in half. Like, it has to hurt a little bit. And I think that we don't always give until it hurts. And to get the benefits of this stuff, it needs to sting a little bit. Like, you need to think twice. You need to be charitable enough that it stings a little bit. We also find that nobody thinks it's going to make them feel better. if you ask people, you say, hey, you know, Tyler, I got $100. I'm going to give you $100. You can buy something nice for someone else, or you can spend it on yourself. Do the thing that's going to make you the happiest. 9 out of 10 people think that buying themselves some trinket is going to make them happier than giving it away. Mm-hmm. Research is the exact opposite. People are far happier spending money on other people than they are on themselves. So we sort of this isn't computing yet. And then the final and perhaps the most powerful thing I'll say about this is, when you look at financial contentment, right? Because wealthy is relative, right? There's always going to be someone richer.
Yep.
There's usually someone poorer, just in dollars and cents terms. But when you look at financial contentment, which is how wealthy do people feel, there are two things that are equally predictive. The first is exactly what you would think, which is how much money do they have, right? You know, how much money do they have, understandably, is highly correlated with how wealthy do they feel. The thing that is equally as predictive is how generous are they. Mm. So being generous is as predictive as having money of feeling wealthy. And like, we don't think about that at all. Like if we talk about someone as being successful or wealthy or rich or whatever euphemism we want to use, we just think that's about the dollars in their bank account. It is 50-50, the dollars in the in your bank account and the dollars that you're giving away. And I think that's beautiful. It's like all the scriptures, all the philosophy was right. You're not actually richer, of course, right? That math still is that math. Like you're not actually richer, but you definitely feel richer. And that's super cool to me.
Another kind of along that same line, you call out Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning, which I think is just such a powerful work. Talk to us a little bit about how that inspired you and how it plays into that search for meaning.
Yeah, Viktor Frankl, you know, I hope everyone will go out and read The Soul of Wealth. I really do. But if they have not read Man's Search for Meaning first, go grab that one. go pick that one up first. It's the book I recommend more than any other book to folks. If you don't know Frankl, he was a Jewish psychiatrist, an Austrian psychiatrist, who was imprisoned in a number of different concentration camps by the Nazis. He lost everything and everyone he loved. But he found what his sort of profound observation over his time in these prison camps was that the prisoners who had something to look forward to, who had a big dream, who had a big vision for their post-prison life, were the ones that were able to endure the atrocities, the atrocious treatment of day to day. And he channels Friedrich Nietzsche's quote, "He who has a why to live can bear with almost any how," basically saying like purpose gives context and meaning to even suffering and hardship. And, you know, nobody has done more to influence my thinking than Viktor Frankl. And his book is a must read. And it's all throughout my book. That's all about money and meaning.
Absolutely.
I love that. That was a good call out. Jordan, what were a couple of things that, as you read, stuck out to you?
I may be biased, but I loved the section on investing like a woman is a winning strategy. We've been talking about that a lot in the office lately, just trying to empower more women to ask questions, be curious, to learn more about themselves and maybe what makes them tick or what makes them calm about their finances. So what were some of the things that you found to be most important when helping people learn to invest like a woman?
Yeah, well, Jordan, thank goodness these two have you on the team to keep them straight, because women are the ultimate behavioral investors. It's true. So women outperform men in every context. Women outperform like retail investors, sort of mom and pop investors, outperform men. Women outperform men, investment clubs, hedge fund managers. At every level, women outperform men. In terms of this, we'll talk about why in a second. But what's wild is that no one believes this. And even women don't believe this.
Right.
You know, when you ask groups of, you know, 50-50 men and women, who do you think is better investors, men or women? 91% of people say men. And, you know, that includes a group that is equally representative of women. So it's sort of the best kept secret in investing. Hopefully the book will get the word out, but that women do better than men. So why is it that women do better than men? One reason is biological. Women have, you know, 1/10 the testosterone of men on average. And there are certain biochemical markers that make men more hot-headed, more volatile, more violent, and more testy, none of which are good things.
Who, me? Or, you know,
what? Sorry, dudes. None of which are good things for making prudent financial decisions. So part of it's nature. Part of it's nurture. Women are socialized to be more deliberate, more thoughtful, to take more time, to be more measured. Men are rewarded socially for being arrogant, for pounding the table, for being loud, for being decisive. There's sort of nature and nurture reasons why women are better investors. But the truth is that women make up, I'm going to mess my stat up, but I think it's only just less than 1/4 of CFAs. right? I mean, it's, you know, a small percentage of financial advisors. And so it was important for me, you know, as an ally, hopefully to women, as a father of, you know, father of two daughters, it was important for me to help get the word out about just how incredible women are at making financial decisions and try and get more women around, you know, the right tables. And I think, you know, everywhere from the kitchen table to the boardroom table, right? Women are not as involved in making investment decisions as men are typically at the household level. And certainly that's true at the boardroom. The division of labor tends to be that women do more of the sort of day-to-day, quotidian, like pay the bills kind of daily checkbook kind of stuff, and that men make more of the higher level investment decisions. And that's a mistake, given what we know about women's gifts.
What would you say would be the first step in being more curious, or what's the first question you should ask to become more comfortable in having those conversations? Because I think you said less than 50% of women are comfortable talking about finances.
Yeah. So what's interesting is we see the confidence gap is narrowing with age. It's narrowing with age, and among younger generations, it's nearly non-existent. And so what will be interesting to see is in the future, as our socialization of women becomes more egalitarian, will women be just as stupid as men one day? It's possible.
Yikes.
No, it's possible. But yeah, so among older women, right? Among older women, there is a massive confidence gap. And among younger women, it's very, very small. So I think the first thing we need to do is just have eyes to see the problem, right? And that's where I wrote the chapter. And then once we do that, the way that this happens is so slow and so insidious. If you look at how girls and boys do on math tests, they're neck and neck throughout elementary school until middle school, where it has been shown demonstrably that teachers encourage boys more, they reward boys more, they call on boys more, they pat boys on the back more for being mathematically gifted. But if you ask the teachers about this bias, they're unaware of it. So I think the biggest first step is to elucidate this bias, to become aware of the fact that we sort of subtly and unsubtly push girls away from STEM careers, from finance careers, from involvement in this sort of stuff. And a lot of the ways we do it are small, are even well-meaning, or just sort of unnoticed. But we have to have eyes to see the problem first, and then we can start to get that equal footing.
That's great.
I have one more question.
Yep.
And I'm curious, and I'm not asking you necessarily to critique another author's work, but Die with Zero is a book that I think has gotten a bit of attention, and it runs counter to some traditional financial advice. But I think there may be some things you would agree with, some things you wouldn't agree with. And for those who don't know, Bill Perkins wrote a book, and he kind of suggested that people oversave for retirement. They end up with large balances at the end of their lives. And we do see this sometimes where we as advisors are encouraging people to go spend, maybe give money away,
whatever
it may be. Just curious if you had any thoughts on Die with Zero.
Yeah, first of all, if I can sell as many books as Die with Zero, I'll be super happy. That book has really caught the public consciousness. So we did research at Orion, right, where we interviewed. It was actually one of these sort of fun, like serendipitous, not a mistake, but just sort of a serendipitous occurrence. I interviewed like 425 couples about what they fight about when they fight about money. And the number one, this was a blast, by the way. The number one thing that couples fought about was whether money is best used to enjoy today or to save for tomorrow, right? Like, do we enjoy today or do we secure against sort of an unknown tomorrow? And if I ask the three of you, you know, which is the right answer, you would, of course, say both. Like both, you know, both are important. Yeah. People tend to fall into one camp or the other. And if you conceptualize this as a continuum, right, just kind of think about it as a continuum, most people tend to be sort of irrationally in either camp. and tend to like lean a little heavy on one or the other. For myself and my wife, we are definitely in the secure tomorrow camp. And if left to our own devices, we would have so little fun. We would have so little fun and so much money when we died. And, you know, luckily I have an advisor who is my dad, but you know, I have an advisor who has said, you know, my dad, when we were kids, my dad was starting out in the business. He had no money at first. And then at some point he did have money, but he was so locked into this save mentality that it was like, you know, no treats, no vacations, definitely no drinks when you went out to eat twice a year, you know, like this sort of thing. And now, you know, my parents are in their, you know, my parents are in their mid to late 60s. My mom is in poor health. They have all the money they'll ever need and they can't do anything. Mm. And they wish they would have done more when they were younger. Yeah. So it's good for me to have that voice of my dad saying, hey, you're going to be all right. Your kids won't be young forever. Take the trip. Right. There's another half of the population that need the opposite message. I mean, there's another half of the population who are a little too bought into YOLO, you yep. know, and, yeah. and they need the opposite message. So I think there's a lot of great messages in that book for half the people, like, you know, for half the people in the world, they need the die with zero message because they need the message to take it a little easier and to enjoy it today. The other half of the world needs to be, you've got zero today and you're going to die a long time from now. So
maybe save a little. Thank you.
I'm really glad you brought that up because I was actually at the gym this morning talking about your book, and one of the guys I work out with said, oh my gosh, have you heard about the Die With Zero book? And I said, I haven't, but I'm excited to learn more about it. So, you know, the exercise with the health and the wealth, that was a nice connection this morning. So
I love it. I wanted to end here. We've taken up enough of your time. I think at a high level, what your book does so well is it tries to call out the positive side of behavioral finance instead of pounding at the negative side. Because I think we do see that a lot is you just hear the negative of, you know, you suck at this. Like, so it's highlighting the positives. And the one chapter that I like, we've talked about it, like we believe in capitalism. We think the world will be a better place tomorrow because of just our capitalism approach to the world. But you have a line in here and I love this. And it says, investing today is a vote for a brighter tomorrow. It's a practical expression of confidence that the future will be more prosperous than the present. And there's a great deal of data to support that optimism. So let's end on the optimism. We are going to have this coming out after the election. Newsflash, the world did not end. I'm pretty sure we're still going to be here. So let's end on the optimism, because I think, Dr. Crosby, you do such a good job of, you read this and it's more equipping and encouraging than it is
calling
just
out all the
negative
errors that we make. I mean, we all know humans aren't built to save and invest. It's really hard, but I'm with Tyler. I love the optimistic note. So maybe talk to us just briefly about that.
Yeah. You know, behavioral finance, which is, you know, my field, and I have been part of the problem at various points in my life, behavioral finance has at times been used as a stick to hit investors with. Yep. And that was usually, sometimes it was well-meaning, other times it was to sell a product or to erode people's belief in themselves. And that's a little bit of a different conversation, but I think that's a misuse of the research and a misuse of the positive power for what we do. I love this idea though, that every 2 weeks when I put money in my retirement account, this is a belief, like a fundamental philosophical belief in what Dr. King talked about, right? That the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice, right? That the world tends to get better. It gets better in fits and starts, right? It is not perfect. But I mean, we just hit the 50-year anniversary of women being able to own a credit card without a man co-signing. Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, this is 50 years ago this happened. we're going to look back 50 years hence at some of the stuff we're doing today, and we're going to go, oh my goodness, like, how did we think that? How did we believe that? And how was the world so tough? A lot of the reason that I wrote the book, this is the most prosperous time in human history. And yet we still feel profoundly sad and disconnected. You know,
fascinating.
Yeah, when this country was founded, right? If you go back to the late 1700s, 85% of the world was living on what is today $2 or less a day, right? 85% of the world 250 years ago were in absolutely backbreaking poverty. Today, that number is 9%, and it's falling quickly due to the merits of capitalism in large part, right? The average life expectancy then was 35. We're pushing 80 now. I mean, we are living longer, better, richer lives, and yet we're still kind of bummed out about it and we're lonely. And, you know, I just turned 45. If you look at people my age and younger, most people say that they're lonely. Mm. Most people among Gen Z, it's 79% of people say that they're lonely. And so we have this strange juxtaposition of enormous material wealth and great spiritual, psychological, existential poverty. And that's what the book is all about, is building that optimistic bridge to say, how can we use this abundance we have to live more abundantly? And that's, you know, that's the whole hope of the book. So I'm glad the optimism shown through.
What a great message.
I love it. To close, Dr. Crosby, where can people follow you on social media? And then more importantly, where can we people purchase the book?
Yeah, the book, the easiest place, give some money to Jeff Bezos. That guy needs a break. Go to Amazon, pick up The Soul of Wealth on Amazon, or, you know, Barnes & Noble or wherever you buy fine books. Yeah. I have a podcast called Standard Deviations. I'm on LinkedIn, Daniel Crosby, PhD, and on Twitter at Daniel Crosby.
I do follow you on both, and you're a fun follow. A lot of good stuff out there. So, Zach, Jordan, anything in closing?
No, thank you again so much, Dr. Crosby, for joining us again. And we'll look forward to having you back when you have your next book, or maybe sooner.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Love it. Thanks for the support, guys.
Thank you so much. Have a great day. Man, that was a blast to have Dr. Crosby on.
Yeah.
We could have spent another 45 minutes. Candace, we got you mic'd up now because you sat in and listened to it. But let's take 3 to 5 minutes as we close to just kind of highlight some of our thoughts to give to our listeners and our clients. So, what did you guys think? I really appreciate the questions. Everybody just had some really good points. So
fascinating.
Awesome.
I love the emotional part. I love learning how people make decisions and what basis they're using to make those decisions and what makes them tick. And his story is just absolutely interesting. So I was thrilled.
Yeah.
Yeah, Jordan, I thought his comments around women and money were fascinating and, you know, should be humbling for all us men out here who try to manage money. And that's why it's so important to have folks like you on the team.
Oh, yeah. Thank you.
What do you say? Something like, hopefully in 50 years, women aren't as dumb
as men.
They stay smart.
Yeah.
That one's going to land with me. I'm like, with my daughters, I'm like, note to self, share that information.
we talked about it at the end there, but I think something we try to do for our clients and people we're talking to is have that optimistic outlook.
Yes.
Without trying to just paint this rosy picture.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's why very early on in Full Sail's history, we gave away Factfulness, which is Hans Rosling's book, which just talked about how the world has gotten better over time, just purely statistically speaking. And Dr. Crosby talked about some of that. I think it's really important this day and age, especially, and I know Tyler and Jordan on the advisory team, you're on the front lines talking to clients, and Dr. Crosby called it out. There's so much negativity in the world, and I think it does have a lot to do with our media consumption and just the media generally.
Absolutely.
If it bleeds, it leads, as he said. As you know, I have a journalism degree. I think you do too, Candace.
I do.
Fine institution, Stillwater, Oklahoma.
Woo,
but that is what you're taught. And you know, I'm such a big believer in thinking about incentives, and certainly for the media, it is clicks.
Absolutely.
It's eyeballs, and that's what drives advertising. And so they're always going to tell you a story that's going to get you engaged.
Right.
And unfortunately, right now, the rage bait that the media puts out is so prevalent. So it's really important to step back and have the perspective that things generally do get better, not in a straight line, but they do get better over time.
Yeah, I thought it was really interesting when he just said start with clear information and the ability, or no matter if it's a media consumption or what you're looking into, you know, starting with some clear information and how advisors can do that on a financial front. That's what they're there to help do. You got to have to know that information and not get bogged down with everything that you're hearing. So
yeah. Learning what to ignore.
Yes.
Yeah,
absolutely.
We spent a lot more time on it than I thought we would, but talking about just the health side of life. And it's so interesting to see those health and wealth kind of come together. And
yeah,
there's so many things you could take so many of these and apply it to health. But I think it's interesting from him having that vulnerability of sharing his health journey was really interesting to hear.
Yeah.
Very impressive too.
What he's gone through.
Lost 60 pounds.
I know. Nice work. It was inspiring.
But you know, like so many things, I think it is a balance, right? We talk about the trade-offs between saving today versus spending. Mm-hmm. He talked about he's going to have a Snickers bar. So he's not completely depriving himself. He's not saving 100% of his income, right?
Right.
He's going to go spend a little bit.
He accounts for things.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. But he's also going to make sure that, and you can compare this to a monetary budget, but his caloric budget was within an amount that allowed him to lose that weight.
You know, what I think is funny is when we ask people, and like Jordan, when you and I are sitting with a new client or prospect and we ask them, what do you think you spend in a month? They undershoot it almost every single time.
Yes.
There are a handful of great people that know their budget down to the sense. Yeah. But when he said that, I thought, or when you ask somebody, oh, I probably spend $5,000 a month. It's like, you're spending $9,500 a month.
Then you go, well, you make $1 million a year. And you haven't saved anything. So I think you've got to be spending more than that.
Somehow the math ain't mathing.
Math ain't mathing. I looked right at Jordan when he said that.
That's funny.
Were there any topics that we just didn't have time to hit on all of them, but were there any topics that you guys that really stood out to you? Because as this podcast airs here in the next few weeks, we'll be sending our books out. And so are there any chapters in there that you were just like, man, that I love that one, or just a theme throughout?
Well, I loved his comments on Man's Search for Meaning. It's Viktor Frankl. It's a book I love. I think it's fantastic. As he said, if you haven't read it, like read that first. And I actually think they pair really well together because everyone should have perspective about life. And it's certainly, you know, for someone who went through a concentration camp like Viktor Frankl did, really puts into perspective our own problems. You know, everyone goes through issues in life, and certainly when you think about health versus wealth, I mean, we all know what's more important. And I love, again, the Warren Buffett thing, where none of us would trade places with Warren Buffett, even though he's worth $100 billion plus.
Yeah.
And that's a good thing to reflect on, I think.
Yeah.
I really liked the section on uncertainty and just how obsessed people get with trying to find the answer to everything, and what having the uncertainty about things, just the anxiety that it breeds within investors. And we're always just trying to find the answer. But trying to figure out how to stay in your lane, remain calm, and just have some discipline to remember that everything's going to work out.
That's right.
Yeah. I just think overall, the thing that stands out the most with him in general in our conversation today is the why behind your money. I just think it's so important. I liked how he said, associate a why, it will increase the power of your ability to find meaning and purpose behind that.
Mm-hmm.
So I was just really moved by that.
So good. So fun. I really hope everybody enjoys it. Thank you all again for everything and just helping just with this conversation. He was phenomenal. We'll have him. I'd love to have him back on again, regardless of the book. Sounds like he's already working on another book.
He's ready to go.
Okay. Well, thank you all for listening. We hope you really enjoy it. If you would like a copy of the book, we've got a handful we're going to be sending out, and we'll do so until we run out or can't order more. So thank you all. Have a wonderful rest of the week, and we'll be back in December with our all staff
holiday spectacular.
Just fantastic episode. So, all right. Thanks, y'all. Have a great week. Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed today's conversation, don't forget to review and subscribe to your preferred podcast platform. Have a great week. All opinions expressed by the host and podcast guests are solely their own opinions and do not reflect the opinions of Full Sail Capital. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for investment decisions. Clients of Full Sail may maintain positions in the securities discussed in this podcast.